Welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Delighted to have you with us as we're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. And we're going to be, as per usual, following the money, talking about sequestration, the chained CPI, and a variety of things that are facing federal workers out there. My first guest is Jessica Clement. She is legislative director for the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, and she's been touring the country going to NARF chapters and conventions, and so she's, as well as anyone inside the Beltway, she now knows what people in the outer world are thinking about sequestration, the government, and what have you. Jessica, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Okay, then. Thanks for holding on. The last time we talked, you were in Arizona, correct?
Yes, I got back late last night. I've been in Arizona, Colorado, Richmond, Kansas. I'm heading to Iowa next week. So getting a lot of good feedback from NARF members on the ground.
Well, you're talking to people who are retired from government, long experience, and people who are currently working for the government who are NARF members. Is there a consensus? Is there a feeling out there? Are they disgusted with Washington? Can you say this on a family show? Yeah.
But yes, there is, you know, ongoing frustrations from the entire federal community about, you know, the cheap shots that politicians are taking at the federal workforce and federal retirees these days. Yeah, they're frozen, furloughed, and fed up, as we like to say.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot to be fed up about. You know, for years, you and I have been doing this for a long, long time, and feds have always been under threat. So people looked at the benefits package, and nothing's come of it. Now you have a situation where there was a pay freeze that was recommended by the White House for 2 years, and now the Congress has extended it to 3 years, and we're, something that you've been warning about for a couple of years now seems to be coming down the pike, and that is this chained CPI.
Yes, chained CPI is probably one of NARF's biggest fights ahead of us in the coming months. The closer we get to October 1st is the closer that sequestration will enter into its second year, and we're going to be start hearing the words grand bargain all over again.
Well, and the chained CPI, I mean, it sounds like a naughty novel of the 1950s, but it what it means, in effect, and correct me if I'm wrong, is they changed the yardstick they used to measure inflation, and instead of the system they used that has been in use forever, I guess, they would go to something called the chained CPI, which does what?
Basically, what the chained CPI does is assume that when the price of goods go up, you change your buying habits. For example, you know, the CPIW, which is the current formula used to calculate the annual COLAs used for Social Security, federal retirement annuities, veterans, disability benefits, disability insurance, et cetera. Does include some substitution, but it's at a lower level substitution rate. So, you know, when the price of filet goes up, you buy flank steak instead. The chain CPI assumes you change your buying habits a little bit more strenuously. You switch from steak to chicken, for instance. And what I'm hearing a lot from the NARF members on the ground is the retirees are on fixed income. You know, there's not a lot of changes. They are already buying lower priced goods. There's not much room for substitution. As one person said, I'm not drinking fine wine and eating caviar.
Well, and we've got so many emails on the subject too, and people say if you take this to its logical conclusion, you go from steak, as you from fillet to flank, and then to ground round, and then to something, and you keep going down the line until you get to cat food.
I was going to say, I think someone said dog food somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
True. And it's the compounding effect with the chain CPI that hurts the most. So, and they, BLS took a look at this, and they've been measuring it over the last 20 years. And it looks like the chain CPI means 0.3% less each year in your annual cost of living adjustment. Now, 0.3% is probably something you can absorb in the first year, maybe something you can absorb in the first five. But 10 years down the line, 30 years down the line, you're not going to – this is a huge chunk of money, and if you're curious as to how this would affect you, NARF has a chain CPI calculator on its homepage. You can type in your annual annuity and then the number of years you expect to collect that annuity and what the chain CPI would then mean for you.
Well, and they're talking about the people, and there are many people, many economists who say the chain CPI is a good thing and it's the way to go. But the savings they're talking about would predominantly come out of Social Security. These are people on even typically lower incomes than federal retirees, but the savings would be immense, enormous, in the billions of dollars. And put another way, that means that's billions of dollars that federal retirees and people getting Social Security and military retired pay would not be getting down the line.
Absolutely. And we're not talking just billions. We're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. This is coming directly from the paychecks of seniors, our nation's most vulnerable, the disabled, those who diligently served their country, some for their entire careers. And to take this away from them, it seems unfair, and it is. And there are a lot of people on Capitol Hill that are willing to trade the chain CPI for other things, such as increase in taxes, from millionaires and billionaires. And unfortunately, when you have a proposal that, depending on how it's implemented, can save over $300 billion, that's, the dollar signs appear in the eyes of members of Congress.
Well, the beauty of this for the people who want to do it is that, and the analogy I use is you put a lobster in a pot of cold water, turn up the heat, and eventually the lobster is cooked and before he knows it. And this is the kind of thing, if they can get it through Congress, and the administration has endorsed it, the president has proposed it, but if they can get it through Congress quickly, people won't know what's hit them, and then it'll be too late.
Say this, since it appeared in the president's budget a few weeks ago, more people are starting to pay attention. And, I always ask people when I go to the NARF conventions, how many of you are, when I say chain CPI, how many of you know what I'm talking about? And nearly the entire room raises their hand. This is gaining traction. People are starting to understand what it means for them. And hopefully they're telling their members of Congress to oppose it.
Well, I remember you and I, maybe on this very show a couple of years ago, were talking about the various threats to federal workers that we've lived through and been through over these low many years. And the fact is that some of these things are perennials. They pop up every year. There's much talk about them. There's much fighting, and it's not to minimize it, but they never happen. And I remember at the time you said there's two out there that people aren't focused on, don't know very much about, but they're the real dangers. It's not the changing from the high three to the high five formula for equating annuities. It's not that. It's not other things. The big threats, you said, were the chain CPI, which very few people had heard of at the time, mm-hmm. and a voucher system for the federal health program.
Well, I've noticed this in my travels with NARF. FEHBP gets people very riled up. Any changes to FEHBP, I guarantee you these NARF members are going to take action. The latest threat to FEHBP is actually a bill that was introduced in the House last week or the week before, which would remove federal employees from FEHBP and put them into the exchanges created under the Affordable Care Act. Basically, the sentiment on Capitol Hill is, if Obamacare is good enough for me and my staff, it is good enough for the president, his cabinet, and the millions of other federal employees serving our nation. Of course, this would not remove retirees from FEHBP, but eventually FEHBP would cease to exist. And in the short term, it wouldn't be the FEHBP that retirees know today.
And it would be a very different program, obviously, because you'd have the retirees. It would be populated almost exclusively by older people, the 60-plus crowd, and that does not do good things for your risk pool.
No, it absolutely does not. Not to mention, for the way the law is written now, and of course, Congress has the power to change laws however they see fit, but as the law is written now, if you are not under FEHBP for 5 years prior to your retirement, you do not receive FEHBP in retirement. So ultimately, once you move federal employees out of FEHBP and into the exchanges, they would no longer have the option to participate in FEHBP in retirement. So eventually, the system would simply cease to exist.
Well, Jason Miller wrote this story for us on May the 2nd, the Thursday, and in it, it's talking about Representative David Camp. He's a Republican from Michigan and chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. Very, very powerful job. He's been joined by Representative Kevin Brady, a Republican from Texas, Sam Johnson, also a Republican from Texas, Devin Nunes, Republican in California, and Charles Bustani, Jr., Republican from Louisiana, and Aaron Schock, an Illinois Republican, as co-sponsors. I would think those are the five or six most unpopular men on Capitol Hill today, because no member of Congress wants to lose coverage under the FEHBP. It's arguably the best health plan in the country. country. And I think a lot of people don't know this, but members of Congress, in addition to being covered by the FEHPP, paying the same premiums as other federal workers and getting that 70% co-payment or payment from the government. In addition to that, they can go to, and I think many people don't know this, they can go to any of the military hospitals in Washington, and we're talking about Bethesda Naval and Walter Reed, which are among the finest in the world, and they can go to any of those and get, for a rate of like $125 a day, which the insurance will pay for, they get super, super good coverage. So I would, if I were these guys, I would want a food taster when I'm eating up on Capitol Hill.
Well, I think you bring up an important point and one that is frequently lost. Members of Congress are actually losing their FEHPP coverage at the end of this year. They are going into the exchanges that were created under the Affordable Care Act, as is their staff in personal offices. The law does not extend to those who work in leadership offices or on the committees. So this is just another, you know, this is a political move. This is political gamemanship, using federal employees as pawns. You know, we've been seeing this for the last 3 years. This is just another move to say, hey, I'm going into this system in 2014. The president can too, and he's just taking federal employees with him.
It's amazing. The art of compromise seems to have been lost here.
I think compromise is a four-letter word these days.
Jessica, what else should we be looking out for?
Well, I think the thing that we're going to be monitoring most closely in the coming months is how the appropriations bills move through Congress. One of the things I was talking to NARF members about on the road that didn't seem to be as well known as I had expected it to be was that sequestration is a 10-year process. We are only in the first year of these 10-year budget cuts. So House Appropriations Committees are likely to move forward with their respective subcommittee bills at sequestration levels, which would mean, again, more furloughs, further budget cuts. DOD has already said if their budgets are at sequestration levels for FY14, they're going to have to induce RIFs. This is not, you know, a one-and-done situation. We're going to be fighting this fight until Congress comes up with a way to find these budget cuts elsewhere.
Well, I wonder what's going on here, because defense, as soon as sequestration started, defense said we're gonna furlough everybody, and they said everybody but the political appointees for 22 days, period, end of debate. And then under new management, Secretary Hagel is in now, and Congress did get a little nervous and gave them some money and some authority to reprogram and restructure. Now they're talking about 14 days of furloughs, and there is even talk of 7 or 5. Some people are now speculating there won't be any. So do you mean if they bought time and avoided furloughs this year somehow in the defense, that starting October 1, the new fiscal year, they could be in a situation where they're firing people, reductions in force?
Yes, and this isn't just limited to defense. This is every agency. Funding for FY14 will be even lower than that was provided for FY13. And the way, as we have all learned the hard way, the way the law is written, it does not allow for flexibility, which is why so many agencies had to furlough, because they couldn't shift money around to absorb those cuts. They had to be across the board, which had to mean furloughs for some agencies. Now, we all saw what happened with the FAA a couple weeks ago when it became abundantly clear that members of Congress rely on federal services to get to and from their states and districts. They acted pretty quickly to allow FAA to shift around some money to put FAA employees back to work. Unfortunately, FAA was only one of 3 or 4 agencies that started furloughs that week, and Congress did nothing to end the furloughs at OMB or at EPA, which also started on April 21st.
Yeah, they're rolling out here, and we don't know whether it's going to get worse or it's going to get better, but every time it seems to touch a nerve, like with the FAA and the air traffic controllers or with the meat and poultry inspectors in agriculture, the politicians seem to back off.
Yep, I always tell people, expect it to get worse before it's going to get better.
Okay.
This is the tip of the iceberg. Furloughs didn't start until April 21st. More are scheduled this month, and DOD, if they do furlough, will start in June. This is pittance compared to where we're going to go over the next 5 months.
Okay, and you say this sequestration, I had forgotten that, but this is a 10-year process, correct?
Yep. Yep, which means less funding for federal agencies in FY14 than they even received in FY13. This has huge long-term implications, which is why, you know, in the coming months, the conversation is going to start centering around a grand bargain. How can we prevent this over the next 9 years? Where can we find these savings elsewhere? Which is one of the reasons, circling back, that the chain CPI gets so much traction, because it saves a ton of money.
Well, if you do have this grand bargain, I guess the things on the table are cuts in entitlements, which is something the Republicans have been fighting for a long time, and higher taxes, at least on the wealthy, which is something the Democrats have been pushing. Is that the area of compromise?
I think that's the area of compromise. The president has said publicly one of the reasons he put the chain CPI in his budget was because he put everything in his budget. A lot of Democrats are saying they will not accept the chain CPI unless it's part of a broader package that also raises taxes. One administration official had said, you know, the president has more than met House Republicans halfway, more than halfway. This is his offer. He's clearly serious about coming together and negotiating some sort of long-term solution. Now, you know, now it's on them to also meet him at this halfway point. He has said that he will not accept the chain CPI unless it comes with other priorities, such as raising taxes.
If we can do it quickly here, one of the things you said that federal retirees in particular are nervous about is the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, the health plan. And I noticed in this Simpson-Bowles Commission, the new one, Senator Alan Simpson, formerly from Wyoming, I believe, and Erskine Bowles, who was a White House official under President Clinton, and they have both proposed something that's called a premium support program. Is that a voucher system?
It is a voucher system. It would move with GDP, not with medical inflation, which down the road would mean federal employees and retirees would be paying a huge percentage of their FEHBP premiums. It's funny, Mike. Whenever there's a slow news week, it seems to pop up that there's a new Simpson-Bowles proposal.
Yeah.
You get this every 2 or 3 months. There's a new one, and it's exactly the same as the previous one. It's something that, of course, we are closely monitoring.
Well, and this is one of those things, too. You know, one way to get rid of an issue in Washington is to appoint a blue ribbon panel. You know, you appoint them, they study it, they come out with their report. It's a one-day wonder, and then it goes away. Simpson-Bowles has sort of a zombie-like thing in that they keep coming back and back, and many people think this is going to be the blueprint, the template for what's going to happen over the next couple of years.
Right. What people seem to forget is that even the members of the Simpson-Bowles Fiscal Commission could not agree on
Yes.
the report recommendations. The super committee also failed. We've been having this conversation now for almost 2 years. The Budget Control Act was passed in April of 2011. This is a conversation we're going to keep having.
We'll do it again. Thank you very much, Jessica
Clement.
Thank
you so much for having me.
Going to take
me
a short break here, and then we're going to be talking with Fran Valentine, an old friend and former Social Security employee who has some important information for us. We'll be right back here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad to have you with us, and we have an added starter here. Stephen Losey is standing by from Federal Times to talk to us about a variety of things, but we have a call from an old friend, Fran Valentine. She's with the Social Security Administration and known to a lot of people in the Washington area. Fran, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hey,
Mike.
Good to hear from you.
It's good to hear from you, old buddy.
Are you still working at the zoo?
I'm still working at the zoo, and I work the webcam, the live webcam, and send out actually live exhibits all over the world. Not the pandas, but lions, tigers, bears.
Oh, my. And you were doing the pandas for a long time, too, correct?
I did that. I did all kinds of things.
Well, good for you.
I know you have limited time, and I don't know. It's so good to talk to you. I've been trying to get a hold of you.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of concerns, but you go ahead. Did you want to ask me anything?
No, I wanted to see what are you worried about? You're
okay.
Former Fed, retired.
Well, I'm retired. I'm very happy. I also volunteer with the homeless and needy. I hope to volunteer at the Kennedy Center. And as you said, I volunteer at the zoo. I worked very hard as a federal employee. And you know that we did a lot of radio shows together.
Yeah.
We did columns together. When laws did take place that cut benefits to federal employees, and we tried to explain it, and it was very complicated. Right, the government pension offset, the windfall elimination provision, all those things. But we tried to get the word out. My concerns. Well, I'm a retired employee, so I'm not an official spokesman for the Social Security Administration, but I have never taken off my Social Security hat, so to speak. And I recently went with a woman who is 85 years old. She's extremely bright and with it, and all she wanted to know was how many more credits she needed under Social Security, as we call them, quarters, because God bless her, she still is working as a substitute teacher. She's from Lebanon. She loved her country, but she had to leave because of the wars.
So yeah, and the answer is it's 40 quarters, correct? Is that what people need to close?
Well, she was old enough that she only needed 38. That's all. So I advised her to call the toll-free number. She called twice. She's very articulate, and she could not get an appointment. So I called the toll-free number, and I had a hard time getting her an appointment. But I went with her, and I don't want to defame any office. But when I went in the office, Mike, it was like an armed camp. There were three security guards. Now, I understand. I was around when Oklahoma City happened. I was around when 9/11 happened. I know they've shot up Social Security offices. But this security guard here, I'm gray-haired. She's gray-haired.
Yeah.
She's about 5 feet tall. The security guard, we said, we have an appointment. And you know what he said to us? Stand against the wall.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, we live in very troubled times. Yeah, I was just thinking the other
day. We live in troubled times.
Yeah.
And I understand. And then, you know, what happened in Boston, I understand.
Yeah.
But can't we have some kindness? Okay, I'm sitting in this office. People are waiting and waiting just to get a replacement Social Security card. There was a woman next to me who had been in the country for 2 weeks, and she was Chinese, a Chinese scholar, trying to get a number. I saw all of her documents. She had come at 12:30. We left at 2, and she was still waiting.
Yeah, those days of service are gone forever. Well, Fran, it's great to hear from you. Yeah,
they have to be gone.
Yeah, let me give you a call after the show today, Fran, and we'll get you on and talk about service and the way things ought to be, okay?
Oh, I'd love that.
Thank you very much, Fran. Okay.
It's good talking to you, Mike. Thank you. Bye.
Fran Valentine, and we're talking about the days she was a Social Security representative for many years, helped a large number of people, and it was really good to hear from her. Now we're going to move over in a minute and talk with Steve Losey. He is a senior writer with the Federal Times, and he's going to bring us his unique perspective into what's going on today on the federal beat. Steve, are you with us?
I'm here. How are you?
Hey, thank you for standing by. We had kind of an emergency call in here. First off, it's Public Service Recognition Week. We haven't paid homage to that yet. You know, I think the people, and this is a wonderful program, and they do great things, and I noticed the Washington Post today had pictures of the various winners and whatnot, but these people are snake bit because every year we have the worst weather in May when they have this public service recognition, and now you have some of the worst times in Congress that I can remember.
Yeah, it's really kind of a unique Public Service Recognition Week this year in that there's just been so much bad news for federal employees. I mean, we're in year 3 of the pay freeze, and I you know, it's supposed to end after this year, but who knows really with Congress the way it is. So there's that. There's the increases to federal employees' pension contributions, new feds that have already gone into effect, and proposals to increase current feds' pension contributions. There's furloughs on the horizon for hundreds of thousands of feds. There's budget cuts. There's just every time you turn around, it seems like there's bad news for federal employees, and they're starting to feel it. And I went to the town hall meeting that the Partnership for Public Service held on Monday that had Janet Napolitano, the Homeland Security Secretary, Dan Tangerlini of GSA, Sean Donovan of HUD, and Bob Persiaspe of EPA. And that was the just rough environment federal employees are under now. That was very much on everybody's mind as they discussed the kind of the state of the federal workforce. I think Dan Tangerlini is one of the most interesting guys to watch these days because he came in after the GSA conference scandal. And so he's got a very interesting take on what's going on. His take on what he's seeing is that all the poor morale, the drumbeat of bad news, it's hurting recruitment and retention of mid and upper level employees at GSA. He says entry level, he says he's having no trouble bringing in people fresh out of college for the entry level jobs. But if you're a mid level person, an upper level person, they're hoping to bring you in from outside the government into the government. He's saying that he's seen a lot of people say, why would I want to do that? Why would I want to enter a job where I'm not going to get a pay raise, where I might get furloughed, where I might, you know, turn on the news every day and see people saying what a bad job I'm doing, how I don't work hard. So that's something that is really, it seems to be starting to have an impact on the federal government's ability to accomplish its mission. And I think that's something that's very concerning.
Well, and that's very interesting you'd say that because, you know, we know there's traditionally not been much of a problem in getting young people to come into government because it is a job. And given the current market, it's a good job. But the people you're talking about, people who are middle-aged, mid-career in the private sector or even up at the top who might want to come into government to help out on something, you know, we saw a surge of this after 9/11. People were beating down the doors to come into government at every level just to be a part of it and get in the fight. And these are the ones that are saying thanks but no thanks, huh?
Exactly. And Dan Tangerlini also pointed out that they're starting to see some troubles with mid-level retention, holding on to the mid-level people who are so important to doing his agency's mission. So not only could it be difficult bringing people in, they could be backsliding if they start losing people. So that's – and, I mean, we've been running stories in Federal Times about the hiring just collapsing in the last couple of years as budget cuts have taken their toll and agencies have tried to kind of scale down their staffing levels. So, I mean, we're starting to – and, of course, the last – you know, maybe not last month, but the first 3 months of the year we saw – of 2013, we saw retirements shoot up unexpectedly. So all that combines to we could a concern that we could be seeing some serious problems, some serious cracks starting to develop in the federal workforce that is necessary to accomplishing the mission of the government.
Yeah, the retirement tsunami is no longer something that's over the horizon. It's here. Need to take a short break. I'll be right back here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, federalnewsradio.com. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. Lauren Larson is our producer, and she has been earning her keep today. We have been racing around the studio with various glitches, but the situation is well in hand now. Talking with Steve Losey, a senior writer with the Federal Times. Steve, a couple of retirement-related questions. One thing is if you're planning to retire from the government ever, anytime, you have a stake in how quickly or not so quickly the Office of Personnel Management is processing these applications. We've all heard horror stories, some people going as much as a year before they got their full annuity, and some people being put on as little as 40% of their estimated annuity and having to make do on that. How's the backlog going?
Well, the backlog is going pretty good so far. The Office of Personnel Management released a big plan last January to try to fix this problem once and for all, and it had been working. They hired a lot of new employees. They increased the use of overtime, and they've dropped the backlog, which, you know, was in the 60-some thousand case range, by roughly half. It's now down to about 30,000 as of the end of April. However, the sequester has thrown a big monkey wrench into their plans. Agencies are trying to cut costs because of the sequester budget cuts, and OPM is trying to avoid having to furlough employees. So what they announced last week was that they were canceling all overtime for the Retirement Services Division, the overtime that OPM had been relying on so much to fix this embarrassing problem. It's embarrassed OPM directors for years and decades.
Nothing new.
Yeah. So, last month they processed more than 13,000 pension claims, which is the third highest month in history. They really had been knocking it out the last couple of months. However, now that the overtime is not in play anymore, it's going to be interesting to see how much those numbers drop beginning in May.
In this day and age of computers, people, murder mysteries are solved in 30 minutes on television. Bad guys are brought to justice in an hour-long show. Everything's done by computers. But a lot of this work with the processing these government retirement applications, you can have stacks and stacks of paper, correct, that must be going through?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the federal government's record-keeping system was just kind of a mess for years. People would start to, decades past, you'd enter the government and they'd, open up a kind of a manila envelope and start putting your papers in there. Sometimes HR people would jot notes in the margins. Sometimes they would put post-it notes there. It kind of sounds like I'm joking, but I'm not.
I've seen them.
What actually happens. And the government is doing better now for people who are brand new employees, but trying to just sift through the mess of millions of long-time employees, it's rough. And they're hoping to start working on a automated case management plan.
Yeah.
There was a reference to it in the OPM's congressional budget justification that was put out the other month. However, there are very few details on that right now. There is a hearing tomorrow on OPM's pension processing. Congressman Blake Farenthold of the House Oversight and Government Reform Subcommittee on the Federal Workforce is having a hearing on OPM's pension processing. I am hoping that they will discuss this issue, the issue of the automated case management system, as well as the overtime cuts.
Right.
So it's going to be very interesting to see what OPM tells congressmen, because believe me, they hear from their constituents and from groups like NARF, who have been banging this drum for a long time, and they know that their constituents are not happy, and it doesn't make them very happy to see the government taking months and months to process someone's claim.
Right, and in defense of OPM too, a lot of times agencies don't get the paperwork to OPM in a timely manner. They're part of it,
yes,
and also
right.
if you like many people, if you've had a break in service, if maybe you were a woman who worked for the government, left to have and raise a family, and then came back in, they have to check all these things and check the dates and whatnot, so it's not something that's automatable or easily automatable. And when they've been talking about doing this for years with computers, see, a related question about retirement: what's the status of the phased out or the phased in retirement? That is where you could work one or two or three days a week and then and phase out and mentor somebody coming in.
That's a good question. We haven't heard much on that front lately. OPM had been working on some regulations. We should be hearing from them sometime in the near future on that. But I'm not sure exactly when those regulations will be out.
Put you on the spot. Hear different things, dire warnings, and people saying relaxing about the furloughs. Do you think the furloughs are going to come to pass? That is the way the agencies have laid them out, or do you get a sense that they're backing off, anticipating that maybe Congress and the White House will reach some kind of an agreement?
I think that we will see some furloughs. I don't think they'll be quite the dire, quite as much as the agencies had originally predicted. I mean, we've already seen the Defense Department cut down the, 20
days. Yeah, almost
down
in 14, half, yeah.
Yeah. So I think, and of course, once the FAA furloughs started going into effect and it started gumming up the works at the airports, Congress suddenly found new motivation and was able to move some money around to avert those furloughs. Now, I don't think that's going to happen for every single agency. I think that there's some agencies that are going to get the short end of the stick, so to speak, and have to take furloughs. But and there will be some where the agencies say, where Congress says, well, we can't let these guys get furloughed, so let's do it. It's going to create kind of a haves and haves nots. Sort of situation.
One thing I think it shows the public and the media, too, is, people who say the government's useless and it's overstaffed and whatnot, and you say, okay, well, we'll shut down the IRS for 4 or 5 days, see how that goes. And then people say, you can't do that. We're losing too much money. You can't furlough auditors. They bring in 10 times their weight in money every day. And then you get into agriculture's meat and poultry inspectors, can't furlough them. They're too valuable. Now they're looking at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and you're talking about weather in the time of about to enter the hurricane season.
Yeah, that's right. When you talk, it's a lot easier to talk about government in abstract than get really specific. John Barry, the old opium director, used to talk about this all the time. Say, oh, government bureaucrats. Oh, they're all overpaid. What about your postman? I love my postman.
Yep,
it's kind of the all politics is local sort of thing. And I think once people start seeing, this is what happens when federal employees get furloughed, there might start to be a little bit more grumbling, and these furloughs might not seem like such a great idea.
Yeah, it does seem to be winnowing down. Well, listen, Steve Losey, thank you very much for talking with us, and hope to get together with you soon and talk some more federal stuff. And we'll be back here next week, Wednesday at 10 a.m. Remember, our shows are archived, so you can listen anytime. Thanks for being with us, and have a good week.